Okay, great.
And, you know, then yesterday she was talking with someone about Suboxone. And they said, well, we have their...
Ready, gentlemen? We're opening the House Committee on Human Services on today, May 11th, 2011. And first on the agenda, we have an informational meeting that will open on mental health data. Gina Nichols, Scott Lloyd, and whomever else. Thank you.
Good morning. Co-Chair Tomei, committee members, my name is Gina Nichols. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and I really want to thank you for the opportunity this morning. As you know, we've been working with the legislature and AMH for years on evidence-based practices, and we're always looking to see how we can do things more efficiently and a little bit better. And so we've been working on clinical practices, and today I have Scott Lloyd with us from MTM Services, and he's going to be talking a little bit about three projects that our community mental health programs have been doing, and I'll turn it over to Scott.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Tomei, committee members, very glad to be here this morning. For the record, my name is Scott Lloyd. I'm the president of MTM Services. We are a consulting firm based in North Carolina. However, we have worked in over 40 states with over 400 providers nationally. So the information that we're going to be discussing this morning is based upon our experiences since we started working in 1995 with organizations, and so everything we'll be discussing today will be from that experience. As we come into today and look at where we are nationally, the first slide that we have talks about the challenges we're traditionally working with teams on right now. The issues that we're seeing from in the state, obviously federal issues, to where teams are really feeling like they're being held back and they can't make changes. So our job is to try to help make sure that we are not letting organizations feel like they're being held hostage by future change, but actually controlling what they can control and to make changes now rather than waiting until later when it's too late. And when we talk about these are definitely the challenges that we see, because the reality is that we ultimately as a system and as a country have built a system that causes a lot of challenges for organizations. And I don't think it was anything that was done intentionally, but quite honestly, through a lot of the grant funding and things like that that happened in the beginning of the system, there were a lot of things that were set up that really set up a system that looked like this that's on the screen, to where a lot of providers are having to choose between, do I do the documentation? Do I go to the next meeting? Do I do, you know, all of the service delivery process? Or do I actually see a client? Do I deliver quality care? Do I do those things? And so our job as consultants around the country is to make sure that we try to help bring quality care to the center of everything that we do. And we're trying to help organizations, and the good news is not trying, we are helping organizations make major changes that are streamlining the service delivery processes and allowing clinical providers to deliver the face-to-face care that they so truly want to deliver. Because the reality that we see in these environments is that for the typical staff member, they are being pulled in a lot of different directions. And as you can see, this is a typical staff member's utilization chart that we would see nationally. And ultimately, our goal is to utilize funding to increase the amount of billable face-to-face service that we can see. Because we know that that's where therapeutic interventions are happening. We know that that's where the client is getting the most benefit from the system. But obviously, to do that, we have to work on the other things that are taking away staff members' times. For example, no-shows, meetings, paperwork. We have to help take away those restrictions from staff. And that's what we really focus on when we work with teams around the country. Because one of the big misconceptions that we see nationally is that a lot of organizations feel that they have to choose, between quality care or efficient care. And the reality is you don't have to choose. You can do both. And that's the good news. And we've seen that from the work that we've been doing nationally and the results that we've been getting, and also just from the results that we've gotten with organizations here in your state already, to where we are seeing the realities that you don't have to choose between one or the other. You can most certainly do both. Now, you'll see the title there where it says, Making Change Happen, and What Can You Do About the Changes We Face Besides Panicking? To highlight that, these are some examples of panicking. And when we look around the country, and these are just two of, I could go on most of the day with other examples, but these are the two that we wanted to try to highlight. For example, in Illinois in 2004, the governor, who is now famous, has been on The Apprentice and everything else, came out and announced that they were going to go from full grant funding to fee-for-service in 4.5 months. The result of that is we are now in 2011, and the state is still in complete turmoil. And the reason for that was the state employees were not even ready for this. The providers had to file a lawsuit 2.5 months after they were taken fee-for-service just to get a copy of what the rates were. Half the state staff actually walked out. I mean, it was a disaster for everyone involved. And so it's now, 7-8 years later, they're still challenged to try to get their system under control. They are now I think it is just over $5 billion behind in payments to their providers because of the challenges that they've had. When you look at the state of North Carolina, they were facing a budget crunch, and so they immediately went to what they call a revenue max phase. I'm certain that you all would be aware of that, but just in case, what revenue max means is that they were asking their providers to go from grant funding to billing as much Medicaid as they could. And that was something to where they were then able to utilize match funding and make their grant funding go farther. The challenge was that unlike what your providers are doing right now in Oregon, North Carolina did not give the proper guidance to their providers in regards to what was required from the federal level in regards to medical necessity and proper notation of services. The result of that in the late 90s was a $98 million payback to the federal government for improperly billed services. And the challenge that I would present to you there is the state had just completed a review and told all the providers, you're doing great. And it was then 2 months later when the feds came in, reviewed the exact same documents, and that payback occurred. So when we look at the realities going around the country, state after state, as they face budgetary shortfalls, make different decisions, but it is very important that we're planful because ultimately the client impact here is great. And we have done work as a firm helping, for example, in Texas, when they had some of their largest providers closing, to go in and try to help pick up the pieces, get clients out of hospitals, get clients out of emergency rooms, get clients out of jails because they lost their safety net. So again, as we make changes, we want to make sure that we're able to do it in a planful way. When we look at the top three national change strategies that we have been utilizing as a firm with great success, and I'll show you some of the results here in just a moment, we are looking at things like collaborative documentation, which also requires that we streamline documentation and start to remove some of the challenges that we have built into the system, and also look at the walk-in access model. These three changes have been bringing about major changes for organizations, state associations, and the good news is quite quickly. The average turnaround to move into systems like this can be done in anywhere from 6 months to a year, depending on the size of the system and as you're making these changes happen. The first thing that we have to understand is what is the actual definition of access? And as a firm and as the president of our firm, I see this every day, is there's a lot of times a large difference between the client's definition of access versus the clinician's. And when we talk about access, we are talking about taking someone from the first call for help all the way through to the green box, which is our open session. So we're not just talking about taking someone from first call to the assessment appointment. We're talking about actually getting them in with the provider, receiving care, receiving the help that they came in for. This definition, and I know this because actually everyone in our firm presented for the National Council for Community Behavioral Healthcare last week at their annual conference in San Diego, this definition also matches exactly with the new integrated healthcare standards. And when you look at the CCOs for your states, when you look nationally at ACOs or federally qualified health centers, this is the exact definition of access that they're utilizing, not just the wait time from first call to the assessment appointment, but all the way to that first open treatment appointment. So all of the measurement, all of the consultation, all of the things that we are doing with the providers in your state are tied back to this definition, and this is what we are holding the providers to. So as we try to make changes, the largest challenge that we traditionally face as consultants is helping organizations capture and then be able to properly utilize data. One of the things that has happened in our industry, and a lot of it quite honestly has to do with the software, or for organizations who are still in paper records and moving to electronic medical records, is that historically we have had a lack of data, and so managers have had to run their practices based upon opinions and feelings. And so when we look at teams and how we can help them best, the first thing that we have to do is we have to get data and numbers in their hands. And that doesn't just mean financial, because sometimes when we start to talk about data, people feel like we're just going to number crunch. We're going to make a decision based upon financial realities only, and that's not the case. We want to be able to show teams what quality means. We want to be able to look at things like wait times or no-show rates or engagement rates to be able to help teams understand that through numbers we can better understand what our clients are saying to us. Without data, we see organizations get paralyzed and into what we call a retreat culture. And a retreat culture, if you're not familiar with that, is to be on a change team that never ends. And I don't know if anybody's ever been on one of those before. But it's something to where we meet and we talk and we meet and we talk. But making a decision is very challenging because we don't have the numbers. We have everyone's opinions and everyone's emotional standing. And so what we're looking in that regard is utilizing data to help keep everyone focused where we need to be. And so that therefore, as we look at, you know, passionate staff, how we can best lead them by, you know, coming to a common understanding through numbers and through data. To give an example, and one of the things that your state is actually doing and is definitely one of the top systems in the country, which we're quite proud of, is our data measurement system, is we're bringing in reports and charting for organizations through a system that we call SPQM. SPQM stands for Service Process Quality Management, and it is a system to where we pull actual transactional data from organizations and give it back to them in a graphical format so that they can clearly see what's going on. But these two slides are really kind of trying to dictate for myself what I saw for a lot of organizations and the rest of our firm has seen as well, to where we would go into work with a team and it would be like driving a car without a speedometer or without a navigation system. And when we're saying to each other how fast we're going, the response is, I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. And when we're talking about where we're going to go, it's, you know, well, which way do you feel like turning? You know, it's not clear. And so we want to get to an environment that we're really able to clearly see exactly how fast we're going, exactly what direction we're going, where we need to be, and if we need to make a change. Because as we look at data, and we had highlighted a little bit earlier, historically, organizations have had a lot of data, but what data meant was it was in such a large volume, and it was in what we call a tabular form or large charts that didn't have any graphics to them. Unless you really knew where to go, you couldn't glean any information from it. You just had a large packet of information. And so in that case, because it was just information and it wasn't qualitative, people were not able to really make good decisions in regards to what they were doing. As well, one of the other large challenges that we saw in that regard was that organizations were being forced to do a lot of manually collected self-reported data pulls. And again, when we're trying to help focus teams on where they want to be, that wasn't working for them because they were spending a lot of time doing that. And so we were really getting to where we were not able to make good decisions, and it was more anecdotal, person-based, and philosophically based decisions, and we want to try to help teams get past that. Okay. The methodology, and I want to go through these next two slides quickly just so we can make sure we can get to the results and have plenty of time for questions as well. But the main methodology that I would suggest for you that we would utilize in these environments is what's called rapid cycle change. And again, what we're looking at and what we've been doing with your teams right now is making sure that we're using planning times that are quick. We're going to utilize what we've done in other states to try to help understand where we need to go. We're able to then pilot and glean results very quickly to make sure that what we're doing is working. If not, we can act accordingly. But in this model, by utilizing short pilot time frames, it allows us to move quickly rather than, again, planning forever and trying to get to something that's 100% perfect. Because the reality, again, is that we've never seen a 100% perfect solution. So we're going to work and quickly get there as quickly as possible. But obviously, in the rapid cycle environment, we want to make sure that we maintain or enhance quality, deliver care as efficiently as possible, while observing the compliance challenges that we face nationally. Now, one of the things that I would like to do is for some of these next slides, they go through the results, and you can see them and you have them here, but we're going to kind of go through a little bit to make sure we are able to get to the organ-specific numbers. But for example, for collaborative documentation, which is the number one change strategy we see nationally, this is something that we are seeing improved quality of care. And in that model, what we mean by that is we're seeing no-show rates for clients, meaning them not showing up for appointments, dropping by 10 to 15% once they're into the collaborative documentation model. We're seeing higher quality documentation, which is resulting in less paybacks or fewer paybacks during audits. And we're also seeing an improved quality of life for the provider. And we're seeing that already in your state because we've been doing these pilots and actually have some of these systems implemented here already. To give you an idea, the average provider takes 12 and a half minutes a note, and they are therefore going to save roughly 250 hours per year that they're right now losing writing notes outside of the session, and that is time that they can then utilize to work directly with providers.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's a payback?
Payback in that case is when the federal government is coming in and auditing and or state government is coming in to audit. And in that model, what we're looking at is the documentation did not justify the service that was delivered or was not present, whatever the case may be, and therefore the funding would be paid back.
Thank you.
So as we look at that, this helps with all of those areas to make sure that we're seeing a better and healthier system. In regards to client response and in regards to engagement, what we are seeing, and I realize that this is a lot of information on the screen, optically the best way to look at it is that blue is the most positive response, purple is the second most, green is the third most positive response, the only negative is yellow, and what you're looking at is these are the client responses to collaborative documentation. And what we're seeing is that hands down, we're seeing 96 to 98% approval across the board. And this information is from over 2,000 clients from 17 different states. So this is something that's a very large sample size that shows us that clients are responding extremely well to collaborative documentation.
If I'm correct in reading that bottom one on the right, would you want your provider to continue to review your note with you? Oh, yes. Okay, I thought the green was bad, but that's yes, isn't it? Okay, got it.
Coach Tome, that's a wonderful question, and it was in that case there were just because there were fewer questions that did change the color code
okay,
on the bottom.
Got it.
So,
okay.
I apologize. That was my mistake for not explaining that well. So ultimately, we do see the positive responses across the board. In addition, from the access redesign work that we have been commissioned to deliver by the National Council for Community Behavioral Health Care, this would give you an idea from organizations in 14 states of the average changes that we've been able to create in just 6 months' time. And when you're looking at the chart, the information shows in the green line for percentage of change, it shows the percentage of change achieved in regards to staff time, client time, cost for the process, and wait time in days to take one person from the first call through to the first appointment. And so for us, we're quite excited by that, and also being able to see that the average savings per center generated was about $242,000. So for us, as a firm, we were extremely happy by these results and the work that was completed because, again, we know that from a client engagement standpoint, these numbers are very large, but also in the financial environment that we're in, it made a very large impact for the organizations. And actually, the narrative version of that is here in the second slide if that's something that you would like to review, but it's written out there to better understand kind of what was being established. Finally, in regards to the walk-in model, as you can see, the reason that we have found the merit for that is based upon these 22,000 service events that we have captured from organizations across the country. What we have seen is that from a client who is brought in the same day, they have roughly a 9% chance of no-showing and canceling. However, if it goes literally only 24 hours, there's only one day's worth of wait, the likelihood of them no-showing goes from 9% all the way to 25% in just 24 hours' time. For the average wait time, which is around 14 days nationally, once you get to that level, you now have a 39% chance that the client is going to no-show or cancel that appointment. So from an engagement standpoint, we have therefore found the merits and are able to show staff that and providers that how that need needs to be addressed.
I'm going to stop you for a second. Gina, I'm trying to fit this into Oregon. So are we saying this? Some people, the providers in the communities, are using this model?
Yes, and Scott will be getting to that right now. We have implemented this 5 months ago.
Okay, thanks. Great.
Yes. This is simply referring to SBQM and the fact that you all are one of the six states that are doing statewide data measurement. We can get to more of that. But to answer your question specifically, Co-Chair Tomei and committee, the starting point for your teams looked like this. And it was very similar to the numbers that we saw nationally, to where the average staff time involvement to take one client from first appointment, from first call to first appointment, took about 5.2 hours. The total client time was about 3.42 hours, average cost was $321, and the average days where the client was waiting was 38. Now, what I would stress for you here is that these numbers are very much in line with what we see with every state we've ever been in, every organization we've ever worked with. The important part is not where it starts, but where it ends. And what I'm happy to report to you is from the time trials we did yesterday, with the new documentation that's being created for your state and is actually finished, it's going through its final compliance review today, is the average time to complete the assessment along with the first goal and objective of a treatment plan, which meant the client was now open, took 45 minutes. So when you look at that model, starting at 5.2 hours, what we were projecting is that the average time frame to get somebody through would be more along the lines of an hour and a half to 2 hours. So you would see a grave change in the amount of time. And what that means is that we're now more quickly able to get someone into care, which is what they came in for. It's going to increase the likelihood of their engagement, and their long-term outcomes would be more successful based upon the numbers and the things that we've been able to see nationally in our work. Okay. The final slide that I have, and then I'll be happy to take any questions or comments that you have, is to just reiterate the fact that we have worked in rapid cycle change environments all over the country. We have done standardized documentation efforts in Ohio, Massachusetts, and New York, and now obviously for the state of Oregon. We have set up standardized data-driven decision support systems via SBQM all over the country. However, the Oregon providers are the first ones that have taken on all three at the same time. And I would hope that that would represent how aggressively they are trying to make the changes necessary to improve the system and are improving the system. And the good news, as we've kind of highlighted, is that changes are already being made. We're already seeing reduction in process time. We're already seeing better client engagement and higher staff satisfaction from the results. So that's something we're very pleased about and something we'll continue to do as we move forward.
Thank you. So tell us how it's being used in Oregon.
Chair Tomei, committee members. So all of the community mental health program providers got together. We've been talking about this for a couple years since last session. Actually, in the 2003 session where we had to lay off 1,000 mental health workers and 1,000 addiction workers, we thought we needed to do things a little bit different and make sure that we got more for our money and your money. And we started this process talking about it. We were able to implement it, and now every county is joining in at least some part of the process. Most counties are in all three phases. We're in our fifth month, and we expect better and better results, and we can come back to you at any time to report where we are.
So help me understand. I live in Clackamas County, and I go to Clackamas County Mental Health. I'm having some problems with my feelings, been a change in my family. And so so tell me then what the process, what it would have been before and what it would be now.
So I'm not familiar exactly with Clackamas's exact time.
Just give me another county.
But for an example, you'd walk in and you would ask for an appointment, and they may be able to give you an appointment the following week or maybe even tomorrow. This is designed so you can get in right away. It is also then designed to, during your session, to do concurrent documentation, meaning that the therapist is working with you, doing notes. You agree with the notes that's written, and at the end of the session, you have a work plan. The thing about that is that is so helpful is that you don't have a 50-minute hour, and then the clinician has to spend 20 minutes writing notes. It's a new it's a new model in terms of all of us that were trained 10, 20, and 30 years ago are used to an old model. And so we're training a whole new way of providing documentation. And that really helps cut down on time, too. The other thing that we're doing then is the standardization of forms. Right now, you have 36 counties, 32 community mental health programs with as many different forms. And so when somebody comes in to audit those forms or looks at them, the information is there, but they may be in different locations, and that's a nightmare for auditors. It takes longer to audit, etc. We are working with the Addictions and Mental Health Division. They are at the table with us because the thought then, and we've seen this proven throughout, is to streamline those so whoever goes in and has to audit can do it very quickly because it's likewise all over the state.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wagner.
Thank you. Kind of expanding on what you're talking about there. What options or what are you looking at for your audits? Because this is an area that most industries have already done and tackled. There's forms out there. I can take this device or any handheld computer and just check through all of my forms, this, and update it to PC, and it's right there in whatever table that you need it to be in, and you can export it to any program that you want to. So are we creating new paper forms, or are we actually doing something worthwhile with a device like this?
Representative Widener co-chair Representative Widener, it's interesting because we're talking about clinical forms, and we are moving throughout the United States and in Oregon. We've had paper forms for a long time. We're moving into electronic medical records. Everybody is on electronic medical records right now. What these forms will do will be across the state electronically. That is currently not done. And so that's what we're getting to, so you can do exactly what you're talking about. The issue is with HIPAA laws and some of the compliance we have to do, those are private, so you can't just pull up a form and see somebody's records.
Can I?
Absolutely.
Co-Chair Tome, Representative Widener, to give you an example, for the state of Massachusetts, we took 9,700 forms and consolidated them to 33. We're doing something very similar for your state. Actually, you will have fewer forms than Massachusetts, and it will be, again, one truth. And I think that is the main thing that we're trying to highlight, is to have one set of forms. As you're making rule changes down the line, you will have the ability to go back to one form set and change that one form set, whereas right now, as you make a rule change, it's being given out, and all the counties are having to interpret it their own way, make their own change, and so you have a very vast disparity of how it's being done. With one form set that will ultimately be taken into that electronic format, it gives you that one truth to come back to and that one form set to adjust. And for the state to have done this before you, they found that to be of great power to them. In the sense of standardizing, you know, what's going on and knowing very clearly what's going on for each provider.
Follow up.
So we are looking at taking the forms to an electronic where, as somebody out working with the patient, I can just click, and it's not being put on paper that has to be re-entered. So we're going that direction.
Co-chair, yes, sir.
And I hope when we start down this process, we use, there's tons of software programs out there that already do this form work, because I work with maintenance guys, and they hate writing, they hate doing everything, so we simplify everything onto a handheld PDA like that, just check a box and they go. I hope we're not looking at spending $54 million or $48 million on developing our own software for this when we can do it with an off-the-shelf package that's ready to go, that's already been developed.
Co-chair Tomei, Representative Widener, to give you an example, in the state of New York and the state of Massachusetts, actually the software providers are paying us for the right to build it. So, no, sir, we will not be spending money to develop. Actually, they will be developing it, and we have them pay for the right for us to certify that they are a certified vendor, and then they're providing the service to for example, in Massachusetts, New York, and Ohio, that's how they're doing it right now, and we'll be doing the same thing.
Madam Chair, could we have him follow up and tell the rest of our health care committee members on what they're doing with software and how they're getting the provider to pay them?
We'll try to do that, Representative.
Be happy to.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go a different direction, perhaps, on this, speaking from a family member who has had to go into a hospital and then explain the same situation to six or seven different people. The explanation being given to me is that they need to have their own initial evaluation because they have to make decisions based on what they see. Now, I understand that to some extent, but at a certain point, several hours into the interview or into the incident, into the situation, you get frustrated, I'll put it that way, with the same questions being asked and the same answers being given, but to yet a different nurse, social worker, psychiatrist, doctor, whatever. How does this help that? Does this help that? Or is it simply going to be someone once again taking a look at the same form and filling it out? It may be the same form that they filled out in the triage room, but it's just going to be the same form. How does this help the patient, the person who is struggling with this situation?
Okay. Co-Chair Tomei and Co-Vice Chair Representative Frederick, when we look at this model, our goal in every one of the documentation efforts that we put into place is that the question is asked one time. And that is the goal that we lay out from day one with everyone, is that we are going to ask this question one time and we are not going to repeat it. And if it's needed somewhere else in a document through the use of electronic medical records, then it's something that can be repeated from the database, because we have done work around the country with consumer group after consumer group, and that is the number one thing that we hear. Actually, David Lloyd, the founder of our company, wrote a book about our change efforts, and one of the chapters is Don't You Own a Copy Machine? And it's actually exactly what you're referring to, where they're saying, can't you somebody just photocopy my records and send it down the line? So to answer your question, yes, we have worked to very much streamline this and establish it to where the question will be asked once and only once, and not repeated down the line by multiple providers.
Follow up?
Yes, please. And the timeline for this, because believe me, I anticipate that I'll probably be dealing with this within the next 6 months. And I have tried to be as patient as possible in certain emergency rooms, and it wears thin after a certain point. So what's the time frame?
Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Frederick, right now we are planning, and I think this is something I failed to highlight before. Your state has created the forms faster than any state before you. We started our work in December, and the last assessment was finalized yesterday. So for us, we're quite excited by that. As well, they're building the training files and everything, and our goal is to be piloting these forms statewide, or as many providers as will be willing to take part statewide, by July of this year. What that will mean is that we will do a six-week pilot time frame. From that pilot, we will come back. It traditionally takes us about a month, because we normally get anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 comments from providers, because we ask them at the end of the pilot to take the forms and mark them with a red marker to let us know if they want more room or something needs to be adjusted. We take about a month to process those changes, rebuild the forms. So our goal is to hopefully have the final set of forms ready to present by the end of this year, at the latest, if not before. But that would be our time frame for completion.
If that works, if that happens, I want to thank you ahead of time, because it will mean a great deal. Great deal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gina, tell us how this program came to be in Oregon. So I would imagine that there was a presentation similar to this to other mental health providers in the counties.
Chair Tomei, committee members. So the community mental health programs here in Oregon belong to the National Council on Behavioral Health Care. And, you know, most of you have gone to conferences, and you can kind of take them or leave them. They've got some good parts and not so good parts. The National Council is stellar, and I would invite each and every one of you to go to at least part of their conference every year if you want to learn about mental health and the latest practices in mental health. I started working with David Lloyd, Scott's father, about 5 years ago when I heard a presentation on this, and I had been studying because we didn't want to spend money on something that was a new fad or something that wouldn't work. And so I spent some time talking to him, looking at other states that were using this, and talking to our mental health directors across the state about this. And about a year ago, they decided, let's do this. This is exactly the answer that we're looking for. So we looked at it, test drove it in other states, and called them in.
Great. Very interesting. Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, and good luck with this program.
Thank you for your time.
Keep us apprised about how it is going.
We will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Okay, next we have up, I will close up the informational hearing on mental health data, and we will have an informational hearing on foster care updates. And could you turn up the lights, please, Matt? Thank you. And so I think there are people scheduled. Yes.
Let there be.
So we have Pamela Butler, this in order, do you think? Pamela Butler, Sam Jones, and Dee Dee Hartley.
Andy Smith, want to say anything? Came sitting back there. Want to say anything about missing us?
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So just announce yourself and stand on. Start talking. We're anxious to hear from you.
Greetings, members of the committee. My name is Dee Dee Hartley, and I am an alumni of the foster care system. I lived in foster care for 20 years of my life. Currently, I serve as historian for Oregon Foster Youth Connection. OFYC is an organization made up of current and former foster youth ages 14 to 25 that have the passion to help change the foster care policy statewide. The mission of this organization is to improve the Oregon foster care system through advocacy, activism, and leadership. I have been a part of this organization since it started in July of 2008. I would like you to think back to your childhood and think of a memory that sticks out the most. If you were to ask a foster youth this question, they would most likely say entering foster care or aging out of the system would stick out the most. March 22nd, 1991 was my first birthday. Right after my parents started celebrating, the police started knocking on the door. They told my parents that my sister and I were going to be put into the foster care system and took us. 2 decades later, on March 22, 2011, I left foster care and the label behind. The reason why these two memories stand out for me is because they are the life-changing memories that changed everything. Entering into care, I had no one helping me except my sister, but even she was taken away and we were separated for 9 years. How we were able to meet back up, it was through Camp to Belong, founded by Lynn Price and her sister Andy Andre. The camp is for foster youth who have been separated through foster care, adoption, or kinship. This camp brings siblings back together to have a 5-day, 4-night wish to see siblings not stand out and be among other foster youth. On aging out, I had so many people helping me and there for me, some of which are in this very room. Foster youth don't think of having parents the same way of those of you who haven't been in foster care do. We find them as we live in our placements, but if we transition out of those placements, the feeling of having parents or mentors gets lost, which is hard for us to get back. Moving from house to house is always hard because we have to pack the few things we have in garbage bags and move to a new house, new parents, new siblings, new rules, and a new school. That wouldn't be as bad if we didn't have to move for the most random reasons. I had to move once because I asked why I couldn't go on a school field trip. In another house, I moved within a month because the foster parents didn't like me because I was white. All the foster parents that I've had transitioned me out because they didn't like something about me. If my caseworkers had the time to see what was going on in the houses, I wouldn't have been so unstable. You may be wondering why I keep saying house instead of home. To most youth, including myself, considering foster care placements homes isn't a home until we feel accepted, wanted, and loved. One major support system that I received is support from the Independent Living Program. ILP helped me get my food handler's card, get college support, taught me to manage money better, taught me how to cook, and was always there when I needed someone to talk to. ILP is poorly understaffed, which is why only 40% of youth eligible to receive their services actually get them. Sadly, the other 60% do not. I came here today in hopes that my testimony will help us create a better foster care system for other youth. Just because my experiences weren't the best doesn't mean we can't make it better for those in the future. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. That's great.
Terrific. Thank you, Dean. Hello, everyone, members of the committee. It's great to be here once again. My name is Samson Jones, current president of Oregon Foster Youth Connection. OFYC is a group youth led by current and former foster youth between ages of 14 and 25. Let's see. 12 years I stayed in foster care, 10 of which I grappled through, 2 of which were triumphant. From placement to home, couch to school, Portland to Salem, I am ever searching for truth, family, and connection. I live and grew up in Portland, always moving. The stresses of foster care as a child have had adverse effects on my behavioral and physical well-being. Although foster care has been emotionally demanding, I have empowered myself and developed a healthy relationship with others. Foster care is like a pirate's life, shipping from port to port until family is founded. In 2008, I was assigned to be an independent living program client. In 2009, in February, I graduated high school with intent to complete college. ILP was instrumental to my success as an individual and as a student. Invaluable to any independent lifestyle is your agency and needs to be accounted for. ILP taught me many things: communication, leadership, accountability, but most of all, they guided me to be strong. These values and practices I use to be successful in the life of, in the School of Life and Portland Community College. Those are. As a foster youth, identifying my needs in college has been difficult. I've learned to count my blessings, steering past regress in my studies and for my everyday life. Since transitioning, I don't have to worry about what I need to say. What I say and need being misrepresented in the courts. For me, emotional engagement has been especially difficult. Years of instability and negligence led me to various coping mechanisms, whether it was high school substance abuse or missing class. Learning the hard way has led me thus far. Ultimately, I realize how lucky I am, as ILP has showed me I'm a survivor. I am a planful leader, decider, now getting my education here and at school. A sad truth about the pickle sours of foster care is a well-known fact: lack of funding equals less assistance. Beyond monetary, foster youth all over Oregon are rising up to help make the foster care system a better place for all. Through resourceful creativity, we have established community. Foster youth have precious insight to any questions you might have for us. Subjected to life's challenges early on can go two ways. If it weren't for ILP, I would not be here today. If there's anything I might leave with you, it's this: help foster youth with building their community. It's one of the things we only have. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Kylene Jones, and I just want to start out with, I went into foster care at age 4. My mom put me in due to not being able to support me like she should. I was in care for 2 years until I was 6, and then I was placed back at my mom's house. And when I was 8, I was put back into foster care until I was 21. I aged out like the day before I turned 21. ILP as well was a big help for me to be able to learn skills so I could live on my own, such as cooking, budgeting, making connections with people. And I feel that a way to make the foster care system better is caseworkers and CASA workers working, and attorneys or whatever, working with the youth to better give them a better support system and make sure they have things for when they leave foster care and they're not just kind of thrown out into the real world, which they don't know anything. And so I think that's why ILP is such a big part of foster youth's lives. I know it benefited me greatly. I was able to transition out on my own into my own apartment for about 2 years. And then I moved back home with my biological mom, which I was separated from for like 13 years. And after that, I moved out again and got my second apartment. And currently I'm in a AFH, which is an adult foster home, just because my mom and my relationship kind of crashed and I don't feel that I'm able to live on my own right now. So I'm currently in a foster home. But I do get great support from my, like, outpatient counseling and stuff. And that's a big deal for me. So.
Great. Thank you very, very much, Kayleen.
Mm-hmm.
So, good morning, co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, members of the committee. Most of you know me, Pamela Butler with Children First for Oregon, a statewide nonprofit advocacy organization working to make sure children are healthy, safe, and strengthen struggling families. So, as part of our, I'm not sure what's doing that, presentation today, we were asked to come and talk about youth transitioning out, and since I'm the data person, I'm here to tell you some data, and I'm hoping that it ties back into the stories you've heard today from these amazing members of OFYC and highlights the numbers behind their stories. That'll work. So I've titled Foster Care to Independence a Bumpy Road, because as you've heard, it really is. So the facts, and I'm sure most of you know this since you're on the Human Services Committee, but last year there were 13,129 children in foster care in Oregon, and over 8,700 were in care on the average day. Of those, 3,800 kids were 13 or older, and that's really the population that Oregon Foster Youth Connection represents and that they work to improve the outcomes for that population. As far as independent living program, as you've heard, 1,611 youth last year received ILP services, and that's actually more than the year before. But still, it's only serving about 40% of the kids who are eligible, who are on the road to age out with no permanent family. And 60%, that means 60% are going to age out and might not even know how to budget or write a check or how to cook a healthy meal or many of the other things you've heard that the youth learned from ILP. You heard a lot about instability today, and the numbers are that 37% of foster children experienced 3 or more placements in 2010. So the two leading causes for kids going into foster care our caregiver substance abuse and domestic violence, and I think you guys know that. Those are often co-occurring and alongside many, many other stress factors that bring kids into care. Studies of alumni nationally and regionally, there's a Northwest study of adult functioning of former foster youth. It's a really long title, but that's a study of Washington and Oregon foster youth, and it found that on average those youth spent 6 years in foster care, and over 40% experienced more than 6 years in foster care. And one in three of those youth changed schools 10 or more times, and 35% changed schools 7 to 9 times. So what we're seeing is that a lot of kids come out of foster care and may not have the educational ability to move on in life because they missed so much school and had so many classes fall behind. So I thought this would be a good illustration to show you. So what does this mean for foster kids? What are the outcomes compared to the general population? And you'll see from this chart, these are just a few of the indicators that we have research on, that it's a pretty stark difference. So for former foster children in these studies, 24% leave high school with no diploma compared to 7% of the general population. 6% of former foster youth go on to earn a 2- or 4-year degree compared to 29% of the general population of the same age group. Former foster youth, we got 48% who are employed at the time of these interviews were done, compared to 76% of the same age group in the general population. These numbers are even worse. 85% at the time of their interviews had an income of less than $25,000. 67% of the general population meet that number. Again, 68% of the young women were on food stamps. The average for that age in the general population is only 7%. Likewise, 59% of the young men by that age had been convicted of a crime. In the general population, that number is only 10%. So I wanted to take a moment to remind you of some federal changes that have happened recently relative to foster care. There hasn't been a ton going on in recent years, but in 2008, President Bush signed into effect the Fostering Connections to Success and Increasing Adoptions Act. This act had a lot of provisions for helping foster kids aging out of care. It had support for expanding guardianship and kinship care programs. It had important pieces to expanding health coverage to kids who are aging out, and I'd like to say thank you all for your support in 2010 in expanding health care here in Oregon to foster youth up until the age of 21. That was a really important step for us to support the kids as they transition out. And it also has a lot to do with increasing relative connections and family finding efforts, because as you've heard, a lot of these youth, after they age out, a lot of us, I'm one of them, go back to their bio families. And so in the end, we know that we need to keep them connected with their bio families and help them reconnect in safe and healthy ways. The other legislation that's happened federally is the reauthorization of the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act. It's the only federal funding available for child welfare programs focused on preventing and responding to child abuse and neglect. This last reauthorization, however, had a strong preference for DHS moving towards differential response, and I believe that the department has been here discussing their move towards using differential response in their work. So it's something that we've been working with them on, and it's really important to making the system better. So one of the things we want to come here is use our stories and experience to talk about a few things that you can do this session to help youth who are transitioning out on this very bumpy road. And one of them is thinking about independent living program services and expanding the funding over the next years to serve more than just 40% of the kids who need those services to age out with all the skills they need to become independent adults. The other piece is around caseloads. We can't keep increasing the caseloads on these workers if we expect them to help kids age out successfully, because they can't do their jobs when they've got too many kids to see. And it's the sad fact of the system that if a caseworker has the choice between working with a 4-year-old who is in a life or death situation or helping their, you know, 18-year-old foster child who's about to age out fill out a resume, I guarantee you they're going to spend the time working with a 4-year-old who's in a life and death situation, and it's just the sad truth of it. So making sure that their caseloads aren't too high and too unmanageable will help them work with youth who are aging out, which is a third of the population in foster care are these teens who are on the road to aging out. So we have to make sure that the caseworkers have time for them. The other one, as most of you have heard, is House Bill 3471 is up in Ways and Means tomorrow morning. and that is expanding tuition assistance for foster youth who are aging out. So that means if you age out at 18, you can have the last dollar of your tuition at community colleges and state colleges waived. That's after federal Pell Grant, Oregon Community Grant, and other state aid. So there's a, and like I said earlier, only 6% of foster youth go on to obtain higher education. Other things to think about as we move into the future, OFYC is a huge resource. If you have questions for what can be done, what we can all do together, I think the important thing that we hope that you've caught from all of this is that foster youth are trained and ready to be at the table and be part of those discussions and work together with the system and with the legislature to make the system better. So a couple things to be thinking about in the future is the need for transitional housing programs for the youth who are aging out. Right now there aren't any. If you age out and you don't have a stable housing situation set up, you end up couch surfing, and you can only actually get into homeless shelters if you've been homeless for 30 days. So you age out, something falls through, your only option is to be homeless or couch surf for 30 days before you can ever even apply to a homeless shelter. And I think you'll hear later today, I hope they're here, people talking about the high number of foster youth who they find come to the homeless and runaway youth shelters after they leave care. The other one is investigating new and innovative ways for reconnecting siblings who have been separated in foster care. I know the department has made huge efforts in the last 10 years to make sure siblings, as often as possible, can be placed together. But as you heard from Dee Dee, she counted on her older sister to be there and support her, and instead she was torn away from her for 9 years while she was in care and lost the only family and support that she had. So it's really important that we keep siblings together, and if they cannot be together for safety reasons, that we investigate other ways, whether they have visitation, whether there's a cell phone that they can call each other, whether we support Camp to Belong, where kids can go have a week with their siblings who they've lost touch with. There's a lot of different ways that we could help work on that problem. The other option, another thing to think about, is the hotline or venue for foster youth to safely report concerns and maltreatment while in state custody. One of the things that that OFYC that comes up a lot with the youth and with their speaking is that when they felt they had a concern while they were in the system with anything, not just being abused or maltreated, but they didn't feel like their lawyer was maybe speaking up for them, they didn't feel like the caseworker was listening, they didn't feel like they had anywhere to go to voice those concerns or anyone who they could call and say, you know, I'm not really comfortable with the way things are working out. So somewhere in some venue for youth to have a voice in their own cases and empower them to step forward when things aren't going right would be a step in the right direction in improving foster care.
Thank you, Pamela.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. You're all very good listeners, I can tell.
Thank you. And we have other people who are
yes,
wanting to speak.
And we have some other guests who are here also to speak of transitioning out of care from their perspectives working with youth. So
great. And thanks for the great presentation. Thank you very much. So I think we have Ashley Corbett, Diane Egger, Mark McKechnie, and Leanie Garrett.
Lene
Garrett. Do we have any other kids who want to just speak? We've got the adults here. Pardon?
She's sick. One of the people was sick.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Go ahead. You know the drill. Introduce yourselves and start talking.
I'll go first since I'm probably the most nervous. Chair Tomei and committee members, my name is Lene Garrett. I am a CASA advocate and have been for 15 years. I'm also the executive director of CASA Inland County. I have personally been the CASA assigned to four youths who have aged out of the system. I was also assigned to 14 other children besides those four and saw them on occasion safely return to their home or adopted to other families. The four youth that I was appointed to who aged out of the system taught me a lot about our system and how the state of Oregon responds to these youth as their parent. Because in reality, when children do not have a home and they are in the foster care system, the state of Oregon really is their parent. And we don't do a very good job. The three of the four were sibling brothers, and The first one aged out, but he aged out of a foster home that he had been in for 11 years. He's doing quite well. He has the support of a family, even though the adoption process never worked out due to DHS regulations. It just didn't fit. He was actually adopted by this family after he aged out of the system. The second sibling in that group was basically tossed out at the age of 18, given the address of his biological family, whose rights had been terminated 11 years prior, and told to sort of make his way. And he is struggling, making his way. He's couch surfing. He's now 21 years old. He lives in Ohio and relies on other homeless youth to be his support system because there's nothing left. He does call me on occasion. I heard from him about a year ago, and he was struggling to get his GED. The third youth actually completed high school and calls me frequently, and I have helped him reconnect with a previous foster family that he lived with for a number of years so that they can also be his support system. He has gone through a period where he did couch surf. He had nowhere to go. His biological family once again rejected him, and he has autism. And so usually I hear from him when he is scared, and he has no resources, doesn't know how to access mental health services. And he was on a waiting list for ILP for 4 years. There was never a spot open for him to be able to participate. There was also restrictions because of his diagnosis that they were not equipped to handle, a big concern. The other youth is a young lady who is now 23. She has been amazing. I was the only person at her graduation when she was 20. She was told repeatedly by her caseworkers, of which she had 13, while she was in foster care for 12 years. Prior to that 12 years, she was in and out of foster care repeatedly and then finally remained in foster care and aged out of a group home. I was at her graduation when she turned 20. She and I together worked hard to convince school personnel, her many caseworkers, her group home, that she could successfully complete high school. She was determined to do that because she would be the only one in her family as far back as she could remember who would ever complete their high school education. She was not going to give in and get a GED as everyone suggested. The first year I was assigned her CASA, she was 15, and she had been in 7 high schools. We wonder what happens when kids move. That's what happens. There is no stability. There is no one they can trust. There is no one they can call. I am so blessed to have her still in my life. She became pregnant when she was 20. She shares custody of her 3-year-old daughter with the father. They have a good relationship, and actually his mom has come alongside her and helped her mentor her. She struggles. This last year, she made a commitment to me that she would actually get into community college. She's completed her first year, just about, is doing quite well. I talk to her pretty much every week. She does not abuse her child. She does not do drugs. She doesn't drink. She has completely broken a cycle of many generations of her biological family. Her sisters were taken away from her when she was 10. They were adopted by a different family. For years, she was not allowed to see them, and through court advocacy, we were able to at least get her visitation with her siblings, and she's reconnected with them, and that part is going well. But today, she's in community college. She doesn't have a place to live. She's couch surfing. She doesn't qualify for an apartment. She has no references, although recently I allowed her to use me, and it looks like she may be getting her first apartment. It's just a struggle. The state of Oregon is not a good parent. Who do they call? Where do they go? I'm so grateful that we have a CASA program in this state that serves every county. Like everywhere else, we're serving as many children as we can, but it's especially important because I know many, many, many CASAs who are there for these youth when they leave the system. We're that person that cheers them on. We're that person that tries to provide direction. Sometimes we're that person that gives them $50 because they have nowhere to get food for a week. We stand by them, and we encourage them. And so I thank you for hearing their voices this morning. There are many of them, and there doesn't have to be. We have to do a better job as a state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for all the work you've done with all these children.
Oh, my pleasure.
Hi, good morning. My name is Diane Ager, Representative Tomei. I'm going to, Pamela gave a lot of facts and figures, and I'm going to use my experience as 20 years as an independent living worker to give you some other hands-on experience stories. I had the experience to work with both Dee Dee and Sam throughout the years, too. Independent living, fortunately, does follow these youth from 18 to 21, even if their case does close out. So that is a support that is offered for youth around the state. And it does. It can be their only mentor or their support that they do have. And true, only having 40% of youth that can access this is a huge problem. And the wait lists here in Salem and Eugene, they're a year long. That is horrifying. We try and help these youth with everything. The statistic of only 6% of these youth going off to college, that has increased. You know, there's 325 kids now, but 3 years ago, there was only 100. ILP, I know, encourages, I kind of like to say forces, you know, it's not an option. You have these things available to you, Chafee, Pell, scholarships. You can go to college. Foster care doesn't have to hold you back. So independent living opens up new doors for these youth. The state might not be a good parent, even though ILP is funded through the state. They open up more resources for these young people, and they have the time to do this, and caseworkers don't. You know, that's what that program's there for. And we're not viewed as their enemy, because we weren't the ones that went in and removed them from their placements. We're not the ones that removed them from their parents. So they view their ILP workers, you know, more as a mentor and are willing to take kind of what we say as, you know, okay, I'm willing to try this, you know, kind of thing. Whether it is a cooking class or living on their own, the independent living program also has housing programs that have been developed over the last couple of years, both Chafee and Subsidy, and they've grown immensely too in different ways they work, both for one-time funding and up to a year, which gives kids hand-on experience and a support system to try, go out and live on their own and make those mistakes. When the friends come over and party, eat up your food, do everything, they don't have to end up homeless. You know, they're still in state custody, they can still have the medical and everything. And we help figure out how to get them back on their feet. So it's really important, you know, that these kind of things are there. We're not saying every kid has a perfect time, an okay time. Things don't happen. But to have the program around and to have enough staff there and the consistency is just another thing that helps them in their life.
Diane, who employs you?
I work in Multnomah County. It was the in-home.
The in-home? Oh, right. That's been there for
Yeah, they've been around for a long time. I don't currently work there anymore, but, yeah, I was there for 20 years. So, but, yeah, independent living programs are across the state. So, you know, and everybody pretty much offers the same services. And you make your plan with the youth of what they need. It's hard, though, if you're only required to do it face-to-face and you are doing the high caseloads, because they need more, you know. It's not a 9-to-5 job. A lot of these young people, I call them kids because of my age, you know, they need things after hours. They need to learn how to shop. They need to do all that kind of stuff. These kind of things, you know, that's usually, it takes a special kind of person. I'm not bragging on myself, but it does take a special kind of person to do the kind of job to work with these kind of people. I mean, whether you're a CASA, whether like, I know JRP's changed their name now. It was JRP for too many years for me, or a foster parent, you know. You have some of your good, you have some of your bad, but it takes that kind of thing to do that, and they do need the support, you know, to teach these young people how to make it. Some states offer services up to age 24. It's like 24 is the new 21, the former 18, because even at 21, when ILP services have to be cut off, sometimes there's still that, oh, my God, now I'm really out there on my own. And I hate to see them in a couple, 3 months when they're calling me, Diane, I need help, or Diane, I need this, you know. I mean, I've seen some of my young people, I've gone through birth of their child, for when they've gotten married to, you know, now will you, you know, be the godparent of my child? That's how long I've been around and watched that success kind of thing. And it's, you know, it's nice to see. And, you know, more of mentoring college. We try and get them in the work world. Try not to go on to the public system. Try and break the cycle in different ways that we can. And it does take support from everyone to make that.
Thank you, Diane. So. Mark.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We were known as Juvenile Rights Project for 35 years and just changed our name this year. Since 1975, we've represented 50,000 children and youth in the foster care system and in the juvenile justice system. And unfortunately, as I think you've gathered from this and other presentations, we have too many clients who cross over from the foster care system into the juvenile justice system as well and represent them in both systems. Legal services may not be the first thing that comes to mind when you think about the needs of children in foster care and youth, but we play an important role in protecting their rights, ensuring that their needs are met. And you know, if you think about it, the state in the form of DHS and the court system is the parent of these children, and it's important that there are checks and balances, that there is oversight. And there have been studies to show that effective legal services make a real difference in the outcome of foster care cases. In Washington State, for example, when they implemented strict caseload standards and attorney performance standards, they found that they saw a change in the outcome of child welfare cases. They found that children were more likely to go home to their parents and stay home, or for those children who were not going to go home, the ultimate outcome, the permanency, was achieved for them more quickly because there were fewer delays in the court process in achieving permanency for them. So I think when we're talking about youth who are aging out of the system, we have to keep in mind, if we know that they've been in foster care for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, there are a lot of decisions and a lot of decision points that occurred during that time where decisions were made that led to the result that you see. And that also means that there were times when different decisions could have led to different outcomes. You know, I would like to say that all youth have effective legal representation around the state, but that's not true because our workload, like many other, like the ILP, like DHS caseworkers, is too high, and it's measurably too high. There are certain standards that we know effective representation can be done if caseloads and performance is regulated and kept to a certain standard. That's not happening in Oregon. And like everyone else, we're looking at cuts between $32 and $44 million that would only make that worse. I know on the first panel it was mentioned that it's important for the youth themselves to have a voice in court. And I think that, you know, often when plans are failing, that's one of the key pieces that's missing, is the perspective and the voice of the youth in the decision-making process. An issue that's already been brought up is that for many youth who grew up in foster care, they want to have some connection to their biological family and will rebuild that connection to their biological family later if they're prevented from doing so while they're in foster care. And if there is no expectation that there is a permanent resource in their life into adulthood, whether it's an adoptive parent or a permanent guardian, then it's very short-sighted to cut off contact with not only parents, but cutting off contact with siblings, extended family. Each case is unique, obviously, and there are some cases where safety is a serious concern, but too often contact with parents, other people in the family, siblings, is cut off and severed for years, as you've heard. And then when youth are on their own, young adults, they seek to try to rebuild some of those connections. And it would have been nice and more productive if, to the extent it's possible, those connections could have been maintained and supported during the time the youth was in foster care, rather than having them try to seek out those connections again on their own. Once we get to the point of transition, though, I think we need to recognize that having a youth grow up in foster care is typically the least desired option for a youth. In some cases, it's the best available option, but it's the least desired option as we plan for children over the course of their childhood. And I think, unfortunately, that has led to some sort of fantastic thinking that we don't need to think too much, or we don't need more services in place for youth aging out of foster care, because that's going to stop happening. The changes we've made in permanency planning are going to result in a system where no child ever grows up in foster care anymore. That's been a fantasy, a hope for many years. It hasn't happened yet, and we need to face the reality that for some children, they will age out of foster care, and we need to do a better job for them. One of the things in particular that we've looked at is the poor, extremely poor school outcomes for youth that's already been mentioned today. And it's something that we confront regularly. We've actually developed a separate program called SchoolWorks, raised money to provide these services to keep foster children in school, keep them on track to graduate, resist the tendency to shuffle them off into alternative programs, GED programs, that frankly for many of them are dead ends because there is not another step contemplated for them beyond earning a GED. So as part of this whole process, the things that we focus on are stability that leads to permanent connections in their lives into adulthood, and making sure that they complete whatever education they're capable of and complete that and have options that they can move on to into adulthood. A few other things I want to point out are some of the legislative changes that we've sought and that have been enacted in previous years. We have focused heavily on teens in foster care because of everything you've heard today, the very poor outcomes, the lack of attention and planning that has often occurred for them or not occurred for them. And we have placed in statute specific requirements for planning for the housing needs, for the vocational needs, for the educational needs of children and youth. And each session for multiple sessions added to the enforcement of that planning, so that not only is the court inquiring to DHS, what are you doing to plan for this child, what are you doing to plan for this youth on a regular basis, but finally when they're looking at being discharged from foster care, having the court dismiss its wardship of a youth, that the court needs to take a hard look and see, has the planning been done, is it effective, and is this youth likely to become homeless when the state pulls back its support and resources. And then one other thing that was added, because the trajectory of school completion is so important and needs to be focused on early, one additional thing that judges now inquire about routinely once youth turn 14 is this youth on track to graduate from high school? Are they earning credits? Are they on track? And if not, what are you doing about it, adults, to make sure that they get back on track? Because what we find is some youth, as you've heard, they move from school to school so often, even by the end of their freshman year in high school, they don't have enough credits where it's likely they will be able to graduate 3 years later. And even that early, the high schools are giving up, saying, they're behind on credits, they can't graduate, we need to look at an alternative school or a GED program because they're not going to finish. And we need to take a step back and say they can finish if they get the right services and supports. And we, as soon as we identify that there's a problem, that they're falling behind, that's when we need to act and we need to make sure that they get the support that they need. And I'm glad to answer any questions that you have, and thank you for listening.
Mark, in your printout, you mentioned several pieces of legislation we've passed in the past, I guess, 7 years. So if you could work with maybe the committee administrator and maybe the co-chairs to look at those that legislation and help us provide for another hearing so we could hear from DHS about how these have been implemented.
Sure, I'd be
glad
to.
That would be great. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I find this extremely interesting. I appreciate your testimony. I was extremely moved by the previous panel. I'm grateful that you put this hearing together, Madam Chair. I know of your personal commitment. You've spoken of that in your own experience. I have to say how grateful I am to Representative Thompson for his leadership in bringing this group together. Representative Widener's been involved in foster care. You won't find a stronger advocate than Representative Parrish for children and parents. And we passed a bill earlier, thanks to Representative Frederick, on a subject regarding foster children earlier. So I guess basically what I'm saying is I'm the weak link up here. You have friends here, and this has brought a lot of insight. If you'll forgive me, I want to just talk over you for a second, and especially since I didn't have a chance when they were up here to tell. Can we call you Sam?
Sure.
Okay. Sam, Dee Dee, and is it Kayleen?
Kayleen.
Thank you so much for your courage in coming here today and sharing your experiences. I was moved by all three of you. Extraordinary maturity and insight and a positive attitude. You know, if you look at Pamela's numbers, if you're looking at you as a number, your odds aren't very good. If you look at what you said and your attitude and your outlook, you have bright futures in front of you, and I am... Sorry. Moved by that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions, Representative?
More of a comment. One of the things that's occurred to me, and I think you three touched on it pretty closely, we had the extraordinary circumstance, which turned out to be very enjoyable, a number of years ago, to mentor a young man who aged out of the foster care system, and just exactly as you said, he ended up on the curb with two black garbage bags on his 18th birthday. It's better since then. But one of the things that has struck me, and working with some of these people recently brought it back again, we need, in addition to services and rights and regulations, we need something softer, like a postgraduate mentoring program. And we got this kid into college, and there were grants and loans and everything else. He's a teacher now, but it struck me as we went through that experience, having put two kids through college, how different it is being an aged-out foster kid who fights their way into college. It's not an open door, and then finds themselves essentially alone. We make assumptions about, and these are the lucky ones who got to college. We make the assumption that it's pretty much business as usual, but when you really start adding it up, you need things like a pillow for your dorm room. What do? You have no money in your pocket. You have no family to call. My kids were quite connected to my checkbook, which I don't think is unusual, but foster kids alone in college don't have that kind of a connection. And we ran into interesting things that were all solvable, but like at Christmas time, dorms close. Everybody goes home to their family. Well, foster kids in college that aged out don't have a family. You know, so they've got to bum a ride home with somebody who will take care of them on the friend end or couch surf or do something because they don't fit. And I think this is where we could do something as maybe an extension of CASA even to identify mentors for these people, kids, who will provide a level of service, a hand on the shoulder, and something. This came up in a talk with this kid a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about this particular program and the history, and he reminded me of something that was said once before. We were talking about the up to 18 at that time foster program. He said that the program was very good at providing security, providing food, certain sense of well-being, but what it never provided, and it really became a problem when he aged out, was, and Representative Gilliam will identify with this, there are no hugs.
Thanks very much.
And a lot of times, these kids need somebody with just a hand on their shoulder. And my wife...
When they're missed hug day.
Yeah, my wife used to call this young man and just say, you know, do you have enough blankets for your room? Do you need a lamp? I mean, what do kids need in college that we all take for granted because family is there to provide it? Either they do it or you know, the request comes home, I need a check for something. They don't have it. We get them into college, but they're very, very much on their own at a time that maybe they need additional support. And one of the things I'm looking for in this kind of program is what do we do from the time, even with the independent living program, what do we do from the time they step out of that until they're truly mature enough and have enough knowledge to be on their own? I mean, right now, if I were shown to the door, my wife has thought about it a number of times, with a garbage bag of my belongings and no cash, I'm not sure what I would do. I mean, I know Representative Gilliam would take me in if I could get to Silverton, but, you know, it's just there aren't avenues. We need avenues. We need options. And I don't think that's an expensive proposition. I think we have ways we can deal with that.
But, well, that's where like I said, the 24 is almost the new 21.
Yeah.
And there are some states that do provide services up to 24. I'm not just bragging on ILP, but I think Sam and Dee would testify. They used ILP as their resource.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great.
You know, they would call. I don't have a towel. I don't have a pillow. And I say, okay, well, we'll help find it.
Yeah.
You know, through donations is what ILP would usually have to do. House Bill 3471, free tuition, that would free up some financial aid to help these young people have money for that. And, you know, sometimes they have to pay extra to stay at a dorm when that happens. OFYC has been working on trying to find mentor programs and matching up for the holidays, that kind of thing. That's been going on for the last year. U of O, they've had a program. I believe some of you might have seen Jamie Hines also speak. She was also working on that Campus Connections program. So those are things that the group has also been working on to try and encourage around the state and find mentorships throughout in colleges. Because I also know hand in hand, that's what makes these youth more successful in the college, like you said. It's a whole nother step in their life, you know, and it's like, you know, there's more decisions, more things you have to do, and if you're over 21, you still need more help. But, yeah, where do you go?
Yeah,
you know.
Sure. Representative Wiseman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, to the three of you, do not let anybody tell you you can't do anything and follow what they've taught you in ILP. And the only other thing I can add to it is pick up Dave Ramsey's book, Financial Peace University, and abide by that, and you'll be in great shape. But whatever you enjoy doing, focus on it, go for it, and just do it, and you will be successful. As an ex-foster care parent, and having probably one of the reasons why I'm here today was because of my foster care experience, watching the state remove a little girl from our home that we picked up from the hospital 2 days old
that we were under the assumption we'd be able to adopt, but because of their rules, they moved her out and put her back, and now she's been in several different foster homes. My question is, from the CASA perspective and from Youth Rights and Justice, how many foster parents do we have that are doing it because they love the children, and how many are doing it for the money? Because that becomes a big issue in and of itself right there. Because I've seen too many kids get taken out of homes that really care about the child and want to bond in a relationship with the child. And the child's rights are the ones who get left behind because of an adult's rights, and they're wanting the child back for money or for some other reason. And then the other problem is, how do we weigh that out? And then once they get to this other stage, I know I'm covering a lot because we only have a little bit of time, but the other problem I see on the defense of a foster parent where you have an older child at 22, 23 that is still sitting there saying, hey, you have to take care of me, or 20 years old, and won't do anything to help themselves, and they don't know what to do because there's other issues with the child. So we have a lot of issues we have to deal with, and I don't see the state doing anything really well in any of the areas. And if you could enlighten me to what we're doing well, and then we can go after the areas where we're failing, we'd have
Representative,
a few months to work on this.
Asking some very important questions, and maybe we should save that for another hearing, because we have
maybe
still have another hearing.
Maybe in my office sometime we
sure.
could go through this.
Yeah, that's great.
I would be happy to meet with you, and I'm going to just, if I may answer one part of
sure.
that question. I believe a majority of the foster parents become foster parents because they want to provide something better for a child, and I've seen that. But you have lots of great questions, and I would be happy to meet with you at any time.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Parrish.
Yes, I kind of have a weird take on a lot of this. You know, because I guess the question I have is, you know, is it 21, is it 24, is it 27? One of the things I guess I have real concerns about is I don't feel that the state does a good job preparing these kids to really be ready to be out there. And you could have somebody who's 19 and ready if we teach them how to use a checkbook. If we teach them how to, you know, fill out a deposit slip at the bank. If we teach them that when you accept that credit card on campus, and you don't pay the payment, you're going to ding your credit and it's going to hurt you for life. And that's, I think, the kids that I've seen who are in that position, we're not doing what we need to do before they launch out the door to even give them basic skills to
exist in the real
world.
I think you missed part of that presentation, Representative, but we did hear about independent living, and they do teach those skills in the independent living program. And Pamela, you gave us, or you showed a lot of slides. Maybe you could give us a copy of those too, and that would be really helpful.
But practical boots on the ground, because I've seen
right.
it, is that whether they're maybe getting those skills or not, surfacely they're not sinking in, because I've seen it on college campuses where you get some of these folks and they don't have that parent. And I had that experience of, where do you go home at Christmas when you have nowhere to go home? And you leave the house, and how much can you fit in the back of your car kind of thing, and never look back. So I get it, but what I've seen is boots on the ground, these kids, whether we're kind of peripherally giving it or not, it's not sinking in, and we're not getting there the right direction, I don't think.
Well, ILP, yes, does assist and try to teach those classes. Again, only 40% of youth can ever be referred. You're also talking that's the whole age range. So, and just like any of you up there, some of you caught on at 19, some of you caught on at 21, some
mm-hmm.
of you caught on at 31, 41. I mean,
that's right.
You know,
that's right.
And balancing your checkbook and credit cards, and we all sometimes make a mistake. And the boots on part, I mean, I firmly believe that the housing program that they offer, the subsidy program, is where you still are in custody of DHS, and they will assist you to pay your rent. I think every youth that is in custody should have a chance to be on that. So they do get to do everything you're talking about, the shopping,
important.
They pay their rent, do all that.
Right.
And you're right, they have a year of training before they actually go out on their own.
That's right.
And you get to see, you know, because otherwise, like, you know, I'm going to assume most of you have kids. Your kids, they got to do that. And if they messed up, they moved back home. Well, where do these young people go? They don't even get to come back into foster care when they're on these housing programs. They kind of is like, okay, you've messed up. Let's fix it. And you still only have so many more months before you're terminated from DHS. But the hands-on experience is a lot different than hearing a class at ILP. But again, only 40%. It's not 100% that get to go through these programs. And there are some of those that get it really easy. They've had a foster home maybe for 10 years. You know, they've learned everything, and they do great, yeah. You know.
And I think that's my point, is that if we have limited, finite resources, and where do we expend them, that the place that a person has an ability to come back to something, or that they have those real-life living skills, particularly if they're not all going to go on to college, that we're assuming now kids are going to just go live in a dorm. Coming out and being 18 and walking away and making that transition and saying, that part of my life is over, and having nowhere to go back because I've done it, is agonizing. And where do you live and where do you stay? And I think if, as a body, we have to make the hard decisions. I think the housing piece in my mind is the most important piece, because the school can come. I mean, it took me 8 years to get a bachelor's degree. The school can get there in time. It's really, truly, how do you put somebody into a position so they're not in a tent in a park somewhere, and that they've got the skills that they need? So I appreciate you bringing the housing piece forward, because that really hits home with me.
Thank you, Representative. Committee, and I'd like to get your concurrence, Mr. Co-Chair, that we will have a follow-up on this, and we want to hear about some of these, the legislation that's passed and how that
absolutely
is.
Absolutely, and I would, yeah. If I could say one quick thing.
Yes.
Recognizing the time, and you do have my concurrence. One of the small pieces that I don't think we addressed, you guys are talking big picture here, and I appreciate that, but one small piece that originally got me interested in this was those situations where a senior in high school ages out weeks before graduation and can be dropped before graduation. We're 3 weeks close to graduation, and I've heard situations where then they're homeless for the last 3 weeks of their high school career. But again, looking forward, yes.
That's accurate.
I want to put that on record, but I want to go look that forward.
Right. Thank you. Thank you very much for all that you do with the kids in our state, and you're providing good parenting. I'm assuming there's no one else here to speak on this issue. I see other young faces, and I just want to make sure I'm not eliminating anybody else, right? Okay. With that, we will close the informational hearing on foster care and open up an informational hearing on temporary assistance to needy families redesign. Thank you all who came. Thank you very much. Thank you for doing good things with your lives. You're welcome.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. The agenda says that I'm the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. I'm one of the founders and have been a co-chair for about 9 years, but I'm currently part of the leadership team and not the co-chair. And in fact, Human Services Coalition does not have a position on TANF as such, because the Human Services Coalition really talks about human service issues across the board, and very concerned about TANF and a number of other cuts that are proposed in the budget. But here today to talk specifically about TANF, and I have some brief remarks before turning it over to my good friend and colleague, Patty Whitney Wise, who has a lot more detail and information. I simply wanted to help set the framework this morning for why we're here. Back in 2007, and both co-chairs were here then on this particular committee with a different name, where we took a look at House Bill 2469. Representative Kotek was also a member of the committee. And this was the bill that really redesigned the temporary assistance for needy families and really made it an Oregon-specific program, one that we felt really did a lot towards moving the program forward. We essentially created a continuum. I had the pleasure of being on the work group that worked on House Bill 2469, where we looked at temporary assistance for needy families in a number of ways. There are the people that could be helped on the front end with what we call pre-TANF, that didn't need to get on the TANF program but had dire circumstances, could be assisted. And then the people that were brought into the program, we really stressed having a strong assessment process, so that we could take a look at who could benefit most from the jobs program and in what way, what other obstacles, barriers people could might have in their lives that could be removed, whether there were opportunities to do things for a small number of people through the Parents as Scholar program for people who had an opportunity to succeed in education, and also developed a track for people that had long-term disabling conditions so that they could be on track to get SSI or SSDI, so they could get federal disability benefits because they were unlikely to be able to be successful in the workforce. So with all of that, we had a program that we could really be proud of, and then of course the recession hit and a number of cuts happened from 2007 going forward. And I had, I guess, the honor of being on the governor's DHS transition team, and I say I guess because I made the Woody Allen joke in that group about choosing between the horrible and the merely terrible, as we took a look at the target that we had from the governor. The governor, of course, having to think about the budget in whole, and he gave us a target which was based on the current spending without the federal stimulus dollars. And so what went forward to the governor from our group, really there were a number of things that none of us were really very happy about, but we needed to make sure that we could complete the task. And so one of our ground rules was that no matter what we did in the work group, that we would come back to speak out about the issues that we were concerned about. And Patty will get into a number of those specifics in just a minute. Specifically, why we're here today is that you recall back on the 22nd of April, House Bill 2049 was brought before you, which was an attempt to look at ways in which the TANF program could be restructured to be within budgetary constraints. Representative Kotek came before you, had an amendment, but it was late in the process. You had many things to schedule, and there wasn't really the time to have the discussion. And nevertheless, you wanted to go ahead and act on it because we, in fact, have to take care of the TANF issues this session. So you referred it down to Ways and Means without recommendation. Representative Greenlick had a very interesting idea, which we followed up on, and he said, well, maybe we should have some discussion in the policy committee, even though we've sent that bill down to Ways and Means. And so that's what we're here to do today. Because in the end, you have a couple of things that you could think about if you're so inclined. You could, as a committee, send some information, a thought or two down to the Ways and Means Committee to say, we've heard and we've had some policy discussions. Here are some things that we are really very concerned about. In the end, what we hope as advocates that will be the case is that in the end, whatever is done to the TANF program this session to be within budgetary constraints and looking at ways in which the program could be supported with any revenue that's available is that we hope in the end that we do the least harm. I know that's not a huge goal for an advocate, but we're recognizing the time that we're in. And also that we have a sense that we're suspending House Bill 2469, what we did in the 2007 session, rather than rolling it back, because we hope to come back to a place in the future, if not at the end of the session, but in subsequent years, to have a TANF program we can really be proud of. And with that, I'll turn it over to Patty.
Thank you, John. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the director for the Oregon Hunger Task Force and co-chairs and committee. I'm very pleased to be here before you today. I just want to build on what John said about what the changes that happened in 2007. Those were really significant, the first set of significant changes since 1991. And they were beginning to show success. Families were moving off of TANF faster into jobs, being more successful. And then once the recession hit and we had to begin rolling back some of those changes we made in 2007, families weren't as successful anymore, and part of that had to do with the rising unemployment situation as well in the state. There were, however, two things that were not addressed in 2007 that continue to erode, and that is eligibility levels and grant levels. So we have not significantly changed those since 1991. In 1991, families who were at 70% of poverty could get onto the TANF program, and their grant would be in the 65 to 70% range. Today, because of not changing those requirements since 1991, a family has to be at 40% of poverty to even qualify to get on the program, and the grant level is at about 33% of poverty. Very small amounts of money. Families have to be almost homeless before they can get onto this program. And the reason I bring that up is because, in my mind, any of these cuts we make this year will cause more families to go into homelessness. I'm convinced of that because we have such dire eligibility requirements to begin with. So I think as we look at these cuts, to keep that in mind, and I think this is particularly relevant given the last discussion around foster care, these kids had families who didn't succeed. And if we had provided better assistance up front, many of those kids may not have had to enter the foster care system. So please keep that in mind as I go through these cuts. And I've given you a lot of paper. I'm not going to go through it thoroughly, but I hope that you will take the time to read through it and consider the consequences. Our first priority in the TANF Alliance, which is a large group of organizations who are very concerned about low-income families with children, is the suggestion that the program be limited to 18 months over the lifetime of clients. We know that prior to the recession, most families were able to move through TANF in about 24 months. Some do it sooner, some take a little bit more time. If you have a situation like domestic violence, sometimes for those families it takes a while to get their self-esteem and things back in order before they can really move on because they've been so beaten down. These are not families we want to just kick off the program after 18 months and say, well, make do. They need those resources to be successful. And I think the other thing about the 18-month time limit is not, I mean, even DHS admits, if we go to 18 months, families will end up homeless. More children will end up in the foster care system. On TANF, we pay about $191 a month to take care of those kids. In foster care, it's over $2,200 a month. We're not really going to save any money with this change. We're going to end up costing the state more, having more of those children in foster care, and you've heard what kind of inadequate system we have there. So I really think that the enormity of these changes needs to really be brought home. We have been encouraged in recent weeks that many people have begun to rethink that 18-month time limit and look for a way to restore that to the federal 60-month time limit. We encourage strong support for keeping the federal time limit so families have the opportunity up front at a much smaller cost to be able to be successful in the long run. The second thing on our list is the Parents as Scholars program. And also, you heard some discussion in the foster care discussion about how few of those children end up going on to higher education. We know that has a financial consequence for these children and adults over their lifetime. Their capability of moving out of poverty and having good wage jobs are much lessened if they don't have a high school or college diploma. So anything we can do to help families move forward, and this was a program we put in place in 2007, the Parents as Scholars. It only allows 1% of the caseload to be able to access this, but research has shown that if families are successful in moving through a 2 or 4 year college program, they're much likely to ever have to come back on the program. They're able to get higher wage jobs to move forward and be more successful in their lives. So this is another piece that we would really hate to see go away, and especially during an economic downturn when there aren't as many jobs available right now, what better time than to allow these clients to get that degree so they're ready as the jobs come back to take those good paying jobs and be able to move out of the system permanently. The third piece for us is preserving the post-TANF program. This also was implemented in 2007 and originally was $150 a month for the first year a family was off TANF. As they move into the workforce, They have needs for clothes, transportation, extra child care costs, and sometimes it's very hard to make that transition on the wage that they start out with. And so the wisdom of the group in 2007 was to allow for $150 a month for the first year to help them transition from welfare into the workplace successfully, and it's been shown to be very successful. Unfortunately, with the cuts over the last few years, at first it had to be reduced to $100 a month, and currently it's only at $50 a month, and now the proposal is to eliminate that altogether. I would say that that means there will be a number of families who end up back on TANF because they cannot afford those expenses, and they are not able to be successful in that first year. The program was working really, really well, and we're very concerned about that going away as well. The fourth area is the Family Support and Connections Program. This assists families up front with what doing a good assessment and then helping them find things like family counseling, parenting assistance, crisis intervention, drug and alcohol treatment, budgeting, housing assistance, children's behavior issues, and finding transportation and child care. So this is an upfront service that helps prevent future problems and difficulties for these families. Again, a big cut in that program really hurts us all in the long run. If we provide those upfront services for families, they're much more able to succeed, and their kids are much more able to succeed and stay with their families. And I think that we really need to be concerned about helping families be successful together so their children are not taken away. And finally, and certainly none of these are in a particular order except for the 18-month time limit because it's just so bad. Preserving benefits for families with a disability. The other change we made in 2007 was to recognize that there are families for whom a disability will prevent them from getting a job, and that what they really need is the assistance to get on SSI, SSDI, and not be on TANF. Instead, be on that federal program to which they're entitled, but they needed help to get there. And in fact, this program was much more successful than anyone anticipated. Currently, there are about 850 families a month being helped, and even within the first biennium, the state began to recoup some of the money that they put in. So for these families, recognizing the difficulties with having some kind of a disability or a disabled child, they supplemented the grant level, so it was a higher grant level per month. And part of the reason for that is that when you apply for SSI, SSDI, once you're approved, the funding is retroactive, and so the state could recoup those benefits they were paying out to those families for all of those months. And that higher grant level allowed them to become more stable because the current TANF grant level is very, very low. So, again, this one doesn't make any sense to me, cutting back that grant level, because we get the money back. It's more of a budgeting trick, saving some money in this biennium, but you'll get it back in the next biennium. And I just don't. It's very upsetting to me that here's families that have high needs, and we're going to cut their grant level even though we know we're going to get the money back. It just doesn't make sense. So these are by no means all of the program cuts in TANF. Because of having to back out the federal stimulus dollars, the cuts in this program are much more severe than in many others. And yet this is the last safety net available for families in our state. So I want to reiterate that these are some of the top priorities for us to restore, but we understand that you'll hear more from the department about a whole nother side of TANF that we're not addressing here, and that is the work supports and work programs available. We're not saying don't refund those. What we're saying is these things in particular will lead to more homelessness among families and need to be considered as very strong priorities. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Patty. Go ahead.
Co-chairs Tomei and Gillum and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marge Reinhardt. I'm the interim administrator for the Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs, and I know that you are on a very tight timeline, so I guess what I will do is make very brief remarks to you. I've provided you with material, much of which you have seen before in our previous informational meeting with you. I, as Patty mentioned, I am focusing on the jobs program, not because we at the department are not equally concerned about the cuts to the TANF, but because we knew that our partners would be able to fully represent some of the issues there, and I wanted to talk for a minute about the jobs program. As Patty and John both mentioned, TANF grants are extremely low, and even with the SNAP benefits, people are generally at about 67% of poverty. With a job, even a fairly entry-level job, they will be over 200% of poverty. So it's a fairly significant increase in their wages that are available to them when they go to work. And so while we, we, as both had mentioned, House Bill, when we redesigned the program in 2007 and we're beginning to see the results from that, that has, of course, scaled back because of our caseloads and the economic situation. But as we're able to start to see some rebound, we're able to allow people the opportunity to get that additional help. So while we certainly don't support people not having at least 67% of the poverty level, we also believe that we need to continue to encourage people to become employed, to give them the assistance that they need to do that. And so the cuts to the jobs program are pretty devastating. Because I've provided you with this information and we talked through a couple of options that both out of the governor's balanced budget vision as well as some work group options that we as a department worked with your committee co-chairs on, I don't want to walk through that now. What I would like to point out is just a couple of the impacts locally on what the cuts in the jobs program will do. Currently, we have a wide array of services, which include many of the things that were talked about either in questions from you or from the panelists in the last presentation. We had a fairly robust family stability track where we were able to, Patty mentioned family support and connections, we were able to actually work more intensely with our entire caseload to assure that they did get the services they needed to become better parents, to become better people, whether it was because they were suffering from an addiction or whatever. But we were able to really provide a much more comprehensive and robust set of services. All of those services are gone in what we would be able to provide. And the only things that we would be able to do, we have a mandatory caseload now of over 20,000 people, and we would be able to serve around somewhere around 5,000 people per month at any given time. The timelines that we've been able to, in order to at least serve 500, we've had to shorten the timelines in our planning processes around how long we could provide those services. So rather than having a person who moved from perhaps the family stability a high level of case management both within the department and external, and then moved up through a series of life skills, parenting, developmental kinds of things into work experience components and other components like that, and then ultimately into the job market. We're designing a program based on the governor's balanced budget that provides about 2 months worth of supported work experience type activities and then access to work search. And that is what, within the scope of the governor's balanced budget, that is the extent of the services that the jobs program will be able to offer. So again, it creates a very difficult policy and budget conversation because the 18-month time limit, certainly Patty has talked about the implications of that, but the hydraulics of not having a jobs program that will really be able to provide effective services to those people is going to have an effect as well. So again, I hate to leave. You've had quite a downer of a morning here, and I apologize for doing that, but I do know that we're out of time, and so I'll stop there and be happy to answer questions either here or at a later point.
Thank you, Marge, and I'll open up for questions in just a second. Okay. But what is it? I'm sorry that Representative Greenlick had to leave because he's on the Ways and Means Committee, but I'm sure that you've met with him. I'm assuming you've met with him. And so he has the information that you've given us today.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, yes, we have met with Representative Greenlick. The unique role that he plays, as you mentioned, from this committee perspective, is that he's on the Ways and Means Human Services sub. This committee, if it was so interested to, could certainly weigh in with Representative Greenlick and that whole subcommittee to say, here are some issues that we heard about in our committee. We're concerned about these things. Because, as we know, even though there's been a framework for a budget solution for this session, there are still all of the specific details to be worked out about the budget, so it would be actually very timely for this committee, if you're so inclined, to weigh in. But we, in answer to your question, we have had a couple of extensive conversations with Representative Greenlick.
And I think I can speak to the committee to say that we would like to weigh in on this, to let the subcommittee and the full committee know that I think it's incumbent on us to speak for people who don't have a voice. And a lot of people come to the legislature and they have meetings outside and make a lot of noise and come to meet with the legislators. I bet we don't have very many people who are on TANF who are coming to meet with us. So I think it's important that we hear from folks who are representing those folks, and that we come out as a group. That's part of our responsibility, I think, as a Committee for Human Services, that we speak as a group supporting the kind of services that we know not that are affecting families, and especially affecting the children that we heard about earlier, who are going to be in foster care and hopefully trying to keep some of those children out of foster care. So do I know you have a question, Representative, I'll get to that. But I think, do we have concurrence that we would like to make a statement that would go to the Ways and Means Committee to look more closely at the cuts in TANF and in the jobs program to see if we can find support for these programs? Boy, Representative, you're sitting there. What does that mean? So,
I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I don't know if I would totally support that, because I think we need to look at how we're delivering it, even with the 18-month process. If it goes past that, I think we need to look at ways of involving these people into other programs, because we have to watch a handout versus a hand up, and you get people that get reliant on the system and are there constantly, and how do we get them off? And it could be contracting with our schools, where now you take people who are getting assistance from state government. Maybe they go in and do the janitorial work at the school or the grounds maintenance, things like that. So now they're giving back, and they're not just getting something for free for what they're doing. So those are things that I would rather us look into and look at, because I know it's one of the things that my school districts are having to look at right now to save money. Mm-hmm. And we'll contract with our local county jails, and we can have them come out, bring out all the equipment, and pay $400 a month versus having six people there that are making $60,000 a year.
Madam Co-Chair, if I might comment briefly, Representative Widener, one of the things that I think is now a given in society, in American society these days, in the post-welfare reform era, is that I think we all believe that people who can be in the workforce should be in the workforce. And this is what the TANF program emphasizes. I mentioned the track that helps those people that have long-term disabling conditions get the benefits that they need, where that marketplace is not going to work for them. But there are many, many creative ways in which local communities seek to engage people that are on TANF to get into the workforce, as well as helping people stay in the workforce. We just basically we're hoping that the state can continue to have its part in this important work, because none of us would discount the really very important issues that arise in the local communities in the way in which local communities can respond to be part of the solution. So just really very much, I think we all very much agree that people that can be in the workforce should be in the workforce, and that's precisely one of the main goals of the TANF program.
And I think one of the other follow-up, if I may, that we need to look at with this too is, are these Oregon citizens that are receiving the TANF benefits, or are we giving these to people who aren't from our country legally? And balancing that out, because my wife works in that industry, and I mean, there are or homes. We work at Booz. When we're an elected official and I'm at the county fair and I have people that are hurting and in need coming up to me saying, hey, I live in this trailer complex and there are people next door that I know are getting welfare. They're going to Virginia Garcia. They're going here. They're not even the country legally. And I can't even get seen at a doctor. The doctors won't take the OHP, and they're getting left on the side and can't get help to get eyeglasses, yet here their neighbors have an Escalade, big screen TVs, and everything else. And these are reoccurring events that I see over and over that are happening, and they'll be husband and wife, but they don't show that they're married, and they're out working for cash under the table. And we're not investigating or looking into this. And this is what hurts programs like this, because we're not doing our part.
Madam Co-Chair and Co-Chairs and Representative Widener, members of the committee, you've asked a number of questions, and I don't know how much time you want me to take to respond to each of those. Your initial question regarding citizenship requirements, people cannot get TANF for... A person cannot receive TANF for himself or herself unless he or she is a citizen or a legally admitted alien.
Can they may I follow up on that? Can they use their child to receive the benefits?
Their children can receive benefits for the child only. It's a much reduced amount of assistance, and it is just for the child. And that would apply for medical as well.
Madam Chair, if I may, next time we meet, I will bring flyers that are printed out in Spanish and in English that are encouraging people, saying you would be required who qualifies for this. You could have a house. You could have two jobs. And this is the stuff that we're sending out to encourage people. And it worries me because we're taken away from people that really need it, our seniors that are out here. I mean, literally, I had seniors coming up to me at the Yamhill County Fair in disgust because they're watching young families that are illegal aliens receiving benefits, and they can't even go in and get help. They walk into Virginia Garcia Clinic, and they feel like they're second-class citizens because they can't speak Spanish. This is an issue we need to address, and it's our state dollars that are going to pay for this. Okay, I'm probably one of the few people that can get up here and jump on this bandwagon, but it disgusts my wife, my father-in-law, who came to this country legally, who has his green card, who's had it forever, who's never asked the state for anything, and then when he needs help, he can't get it. But people who aren't in our country legally, they do get it.
So, Co-Chairs, Representative Widener, I think it would be fine to have, if we wanted to have that conversation, I'm wondering if perhaps I could schedule some time to meet with you. Could we maybe do that?
Yeah.
I'd be happy to do that, if you'd like.
I would be happy to do it, and if we want to get INS and start going out, and we could save a lot of money to help fund this. Because if we know their children are on it and the parents are here illegally, we should probably go and do something about it.
So how much would, if somebody were here illegally and their children were getting benefits, can you give us a range what those benefits might be?
You know, I was...
That's fine. Co-chairs. Maybe get that to us
and later. Yeah, representatives of the committee. It is a much reduced amount. It would be better for me to get you...
Right.
We have tables that would show it for various family sizes.
Right.
So
and
I could do that.
And if you could get that, if the two of you could meet, and maybe we could deal with this
then
issue again, having more concrete information, that would be terrific.
Any other questions
for anyone on this panel? I think that the co-chair and I would be glad to sign a statement regarding these issues. And it may not represent the full committee, but I think that we would be willing to
certainly
do that.
Certainly represent me, so thank you.
Okay. All right. Good. Do that. All right. Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much
for coming today.
Thank you. Thanks for the work that you do. With that, we will close the informational hearing on temporary assistance to needy families, and we will close the House Committee on Human Services.